This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of July 24th, here are a few top stories. The House of Representatives voted largely along party lines to fund a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border this week. It's the first step in shoring up a cornerstone of candidate Donald Trump's campaign pledge. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports.
Funding for the border wall was packed into a measure that would pay for everything from more fighter jets for the Pentagon to energy and water, but it was the most contentious. Tucson Democrat Raul Grijalva has been critical of the border wall since candidate Trump first announced his plans in 2016 and then pushed them through with a decision Wednesday to ban transgendered Americans from serving in the military.
I think that even makes the whole situation more disgusting than it already is.
Mesa Republican Andy Biggs cast a yes vote Thursday and said in a statement that a border wall is, quote, vital. Southern Arizona Congresswoman Martha McSally voted for the measure and applauded the military inclusions in the bill, but made no mention of the allotted $1.57 billion for the border wall. Construction is supposed to begin in Texas and California. It is unclear whether any construction would take place in Arizona. Most of Arizona's 378-mile border with Mexico has either an existing bollard fence or a vehicle barrier on the boundary. Santa Cruz County Sheriff Tony Estrada considers more construction in that county to be unnecessary.
Definitely, we don't need it. And there's places, obviously, where you can't even start to build a wall here. So, no, definitely, I think we've got what we need here.
Soil testing already began in the Rio Grande Valley, where one of the border wall projects involves adding more fences on top of levees. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And now, from KJZZ's The Show.
The sedative midazolam is usually used before colonoscopies or dental surgeries. It puts you to sleep before you go under the knife and induces amnesia so you don't remember it. But in recent years, the drug has been used as part of a cocktail of drugs used in carrying out executions for death row inmates around the country. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with the man who helped invent this drug. And Lauren, it turns out he's retired in Tucson?
Yes. Armin Walser is a Swiss chemist who worked for the pharmaceutical company Hoffmann La Roche through his long career. And we tracked him down at his home in Tucson. He says he's been contacted by a lot of reporters recently as the drug he invented in the 1970s has become central to the debate surrounding capital punishment in this country.
No, I was not happy. I only learned very late. About 2 years ago, I learned about this from a reporter in Oklahoma that they're using midazolam for capital punishment. I mean, to induce sedation before they inject potassium bromide. I'm not for the death penalty.
It all started as he searched for an injectable replacement for Valium. He says they finally came across the right combination in 1973.
When they did the clinical trials, they found some changes which they liked. It was shorter acting than Valium. It was immediately active, and it didn't have to undergo a biotransformation first, and that it had amnesic properties superior to Valium.
And this went on to become a very successful drug. It's used in hospitals and clinics around the country for patients who are about to undergo anesthesia.
So what did he think when he realized his life's work was being used to help kill people on death row?
Right. As you might expect, he was uncomfortable with the idea.
I was kind of surprised. But going back to the history of midazolam over the last 20 years or so, 30 years, there were cases where midazolam did not do the job. And I'm not sure whether that's the case, but in my opinion, the interaction of midazolam with the benzodiazepine receptor may not be as effective in all people. You know?
And the question of whether this drug causes prisoners an unconstitutional amount of pain is one of the major points that's debated here. The Supreme Court upheld the use of midazolam in a case from Oklahoma in 2015, but one of the most notorious cases happened here in Arizona in 2014 when Joseph Wood was executed using midazolam to put him to sleep and a narcotic. The combination was meant to be lethal, but he didn't die right away. Wood gasped and snorted in the execution chamber for nearly 2 hours before he he died, and he was injected 15 times. So Walser says he doesn't know what happened in this case, but he believes there are individual sensitivities to the drug that he helped create.
It's not, let's say, 100% effective sedative, not in all people. Maybe 99% or 98%. I'm not sure about that, but that's my explanation of what, that they could not sedate one person.
And the Joseph Wood case has led to lawsuits in our state over how the state carried out executions. But Lauren, this all also has to do with a larger debate around what states can do as execution drugs become more and more difficult to obtain, right?
Exactly. In fact, Roche, the company that Walser used to work for, said in 2015 that it did not supply midazolam for use in the death penalty, and it wouldn't knowingly do that, according to the New York Times. Arizona's Department of Corrections has now agreed that it won't use midazolam as part of lethal injections. But all of this has left Walser, who has never supported the death penalty, in a difficult position. After all, midazolam is one of his career highlights, and it's part of his legacy.
Very few medicinal chemists ever have a drug that's marketable or that becomes a product. So in that case, I'm one of the few that was lucky enough to find a marketable product. And many of them worked their life in research, and they never have enough luck to find one. So I'm proud that I made it and that it was helping many people. And it's unfortunate that they thought it would really be the best for pre-anesthesia for capital punishment.
The show is Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast in the world of business.
Music takes hold of you, and when it's good, it doesn't let go of you. The Columbia Record and Tape Club can help you get a lot more music. Just find our ad. It's in your Sunday paper.
Yeah, Mark, you and I both had the mail order service that would send stacks of records or tapes to subscribers every month.
So many tapes.
Sure, our parents loved it because if you didn't send it back.
So many tapes.
They're just a memory now, but subscription services are more popular than ever before for virtually every aspect of retail.
Yeah, there are services for razors, makeup samples, Japanese import snacks, and socks, all delivered to doorsteps across the country.
Millions of venture capital bucks later, how is the subscription market doing? We open it up to the show's Annika Klein for more.
I might be one of those weird millennials who has never signed up for a monthly subscription box. So I went to someone I know who does get one.
Okay, so I am a cat person, so it should be no surprise that I get the Cat Lady box.
Besides being a cat person, Kaylee Monahan is a coworker of mine.
And it's, I guess, the deluxe version because it comes with stuff for me and my cat.
Things like an umbrella with a cat face on it, a t-shirt.
You had me at meow.
A couple cat toys. All the items are a surprise to the subscriber. It's like opening up a gift you sent yourself. And in this case, also your cats.
You know, bonus, you know, cats in boxes, they like to sit in the box afterwards.
Oh, so really it is three cat toys.
It is.
But is there a point where you max out on cat items?
Yes, I feel like I've actually reached that limit now. I'm like, okay, this has been fun for the last few months, but I'm probably going to cancel and not spend the money on it. Because it is fun, but it kind of loses its luster after a while.
And that explains one of the toughest challenges in the subscription box industry.
The key is still, like it has always been, having a selection of products that are going to be interesting on a regular basis.
John Fetto is a senior analyst at Hitwise. He looks at retail data, and he's been following the subscription side for a few years now by tracking how many people visit the top 270 subscription box websites, including Stitch Fix, Dollar Shave Club, and Blue Apron. Fetto says in the past 3 years, they've seen visits to those websites soar. There were 37 million visits in May alone. And certain categories are having a shining moment. The pet sector is way up from last year. The food sector is also climbing.
Farm fresh ingredients, step-by-step recipes, delivered to your door.
Subscription box websites snag about 1% of all web traffic to retail brands. So people are still visiting traditional retail websites a lot more. But 1% is also nothing to sneeze at. Traditional brands have certainly noticed the subscription model, Fetto says, because they've started to follow suit.
Whether that is something like Sephora launching their Playbox or Starbucks launching their roastery subscription.
Walmart, Target, Amazon, they're all in the game now. So will the market stay unique? Or will these boxes turn into miniature versions of the same stores you find around your local shopping complex?
You know, the subscription industry, really is very much still like a startup space, and you still see a lot of 1-2 person companies that are trying to carve out their specific niche in the market.
Liz Cadman has made a full-time job out of opening these boxes and reviewing them on her website, My Subscription Addiction.
I would say I've definitely opened hundreds, if not thousands, of boxes.
And many of those are still what you'd call the little guys. They can't compete with Walmart or Target, but maybe they have an item or two that you really can't get anywhere else.
In some sense, you know, because they're small, they're able to work with these other makers that might not have been able to fulfill orders for a subscription box that's shipping, you know, 100,000 boxes, but something under 10,000 they can do.
A lot of brands contact me, I found out.
Jennifer King started Daisy Bee here in the Valley. It's a tiny operation. King ships out boxes from her own home for moms-to-be and new moms. And those boxes often have items from other really small sellers.
I mean, if I made a physical product, I would gladly sell somebody 100 of them. From that point of view, it's just probably easier for them.
So she says finding items isn't the problem. But she's wary of how long the subscription trend will hold. How long will customers want to receive surprise items for their baby or dog or shoe collection? And what about the items they don't want to keep? Within that puzzle is, of course, another business idea. Here's Liz Cadman again, the box reviewer.
We actually built out a swapping platform on our site, similar to eBay in that you list out all the products you have, and then you can go swap with other your fellow subscribers.
Thus ordering a box of someone else's subscription box leftovers, and maybe keeping the trend moving. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
The most common type of volcano in the world is one that only explodes once, and yet relatively little is known about what is called monogenetic volcanoes. A group of students from Northern Arizona University is studying them in central Mexico. They want to answer questions about volcanoes in many places. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports.
This doesn't have the obvious look of a volcano. It's a massive crater with 1,200-foot cliffs and a large, deep blue lake at the bottom. Families from the nearby town of Aljojuca like to come here and have picnics by the water. That includes Adriana Hernandez Martinez, her husband, and their two daughters. When Martinez herself was a little girl, she heard a story about the lake.
Bueno, como yo me la sé, te la cuento. Okay, mira.
Legend has it that one time, when Aljojuca was going through a drought, neighbors noticed a cow returned with its hooves wet from grazing. So they followed it and the girl who owned it back to its pasture.
Y cuando llegaron, pues sí, efectivamente había un charquito de agua, ¿no?
That's when they discovered a puddle.
Según cuenta la leyenda que la niña, pues es la sirena.
And on that day, according to legend, the little girl and her cow got in the water, turned into a mermaid, and made the puddle swell into a lagoon.
Pues los dos me gustan. Pues sí, porque...
Martinez likes the legend, she says, but also the reality. This lake formed at the bottom of a volcanic crater.
Okay.
8 students from Northern Arizona University and the National Autonomous University of Mexico are studying this volcano and another one near here in what is called the Cerdán Oriental Volcanic Field. They want to figure out exactly what's beneath the surface, and that, in turn, will help them better understand why the volcanoes look the way they do above ground.
Okay.
Earlier this month, they pounded a sledgehammer against a metal plate on hundreds of points along the volcano's surfaces. They also used sophisticated magnets to measure the gravitational pull and the electrical resistance at different points.
Dos más.
Ryan Porter is an assistant professor of geophysics at Northern Arizona University. He helped interpret the data they generated with the hammer.
Bien. So basically what we're doing with the sledgehammer is we're generating a small earthquake.
This sends vibrations that travel through the earth. They hit rocks and bounce back to special sensors on the surface.
And from that, we can use that to infer what the composition is, what type of rock is in the subsurface, and the structure of it, so basically the shape.
In other words, they're trying to make a map of the volcano's plumbing.
That is actually a perfect way to say it. This is ultimately what we're trying to find, is the plumbing of these systems, and take the lessons we learn here to apply it to other systems like Northern Arizona, where we have similar type of volcanism.
Indeed, this field is similar to the San Francisco volcanic field just north of Flagstaff. The volcanoes are 20,000 years old or younger, and many of them erupted when magma came in contact with underground water, created steam, pressure, and then an explosion. Shannon Reese is a master's student whose research focuses on the San Francisco field.
In the San Francisco volcanic field, a lot of them erupted out of a side, so they're actually asymmetrical. So they'll be taller on one side, and the vent will be sideways.
Which helps explain why volcanoes come in so many different shapes. What most of us imagine as a volcano is only one type.
Those are more stratovolcanoes. Everybody thinks of Mount St. Helens when they think of a volcano or something like that.
Or Lord of the Rings.
Or Lord of the Rings, that too. Yeah, so even that's a different volcano. The scoria cone.
Here in Aljojuca, the students from Arizona and Mexico gathered seismic data that they'll be studying this year. The data won't tell them anything about a legend or a mermaid, but they believe they'll tell them when the volcanoes exploded, for how long, and where the magma came from. With that, they hope they can better explain why the surface looks the way it does here in Arizona and elsewhere. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, reporting from Puebla, Mexico.
Defense Department-funded brain hacking studies underway in Arizona seek to help soldiers learn more efficiently. But does the technique pose risks and raise ethical questions? From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis reports.
Whether mathematicians or marathoners, chasing mastery often runs us into a wall that blocks further progress. Now, 8 DOD brain studies, one at Arizona State University, aim to help soldiers break through it.
Our focus is really on enhancement, and enhancement in people who are superior performers already.
ASU neuroscientist Stephen Helms-Tillery leads the project, which studies how a key brain chemical, norepinephrine, affects skills like marksmanship that link senses, decisions, and actions.
Norepinephrine is essentially the fight-or-flight neuromodulator.
When you wake up to a strange sound, tense, eyes wide, ears straining, that's norepinephrine flooding your brain. ASU neuroscientist Chris Bonello.
So you're able to attend more to what you're doing, that will accelerate the learning process.
Norepinephrine also affects neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to rewire itself, to react, repair, and learn. But how remains unclear.
But one of the things that we think happens with norepinephrine is it sort of enhances what we call the signal-to-noise ratio.
The brain is organized chaos. It's noisy, not just with voices of doubt and recrimination, but with signals.
For something of interest to sort of come to your attention, it has to step out of that noise a little bit.
Like a baseline. Providing that chemical bass boost is the brainstem's locus coeruleus. Scientists can trigger the area non-surgically by zapping certain nerves. ASU will use the trigeminal nerve in the face.
Actually, this is kind of the big gap, is the link between the stimulation of these peripheral nerves and the cortical changes.
So, zap a facial nerve to trigger the brain to release a chemical to improve learning. Sounds good, but broad. How to boost the signal and not the noise?
It's going to be equally important to devise tasks that sort of challenge the brain while you're providing the stimulation and finding the right type of task.
For example, a sharpshooter might play a computer-based aiming game with ever-changing physics rules.
So people are always sort of have to be on their toes and capable of learning this new task.
Later on, we'll add other tasks that involve explicit decision-making.
Effective or not, such research raises ethical questions. It dips its toe into the vast ocean of possibility and societal ripples that brain augmentation represents. In the short term, despite precautions and monitoring, side effects are possible, as is addiction.
We do think that we'll probably be activating reward circuits as well. And so if you're activating reward circuits and hedonic circuits, then the possibility for addiction is, I think, potential. It's not zero.
And for some, using such techniques to build a better soldier only deepens the moral fog. Bioethicist Jason Robert.
Of course we should be worried about building better warfighters. At the same time, we also should be worried about making sure that the warfighters we have are not being inappropriately sacrificed because we haven't done what we could do.
Review boards weigh such risks against benefits before signing off on work with human or animal subjects. But some questions reach beyond their purview.
What it means to be human, what it means to learn, what it means to function as part of a civilization.
What those answers might be, only time will tell. But the researchers hope their work might one day help people with cognitive declines and impairments.
Could be Alzheimer's, could be stroke, could be anything where, you know, enhancing the learning process would be beneficial.
Many ifs and quite some time stand between this work and those possibilities. But then hope, too, is good for the brain. Nicholas Gerbus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally this week, a look at a development in education.
The latest numbers show Arizona is still in the midst of a dire shortage of teachers in our classrooms. A recent report from the Morrison Institute at ASU showed 74% of Arizona school administrators said their campuses don't have enough teachers. Now the Department of Education is starting a pilot program that aims to help current teachers here get certified to transfer into high-need fields. The High Quality Teacher Professional Development Pilot Program is accepting applications now for teachers who want to get up to $2,000 for training at an accredited post-secondary institution. And the show's Lauren Gilger joins me now with more on this. And Lauren, this started with a bill that passed through the state legislature earlier this year, right?
Right. That bill was introduced last session by Sylvia Allen, and it allocated $300,000 to fund professional development programs for public school teachers in our state to get additional certifications in high-need areas like science, information, and technology, those all-important STEM fields, as well as in career and technical education. So the money comes with strings attached, though. Teachers who get it are required to teach in an Arizona public school for 3 years after, or they'll have to pay it back. I went down to the Department of Education to find out some more about this, and I sat down with Alexis Sussdorf. She's senior policy analyst with the department. She saw this bill through the process at the legislature and has been involved in the implementation of the new program.
We opened the application window last week, and we have seen a couple dozen applications so far, and this opportunity will be available to 150 educators, up to $2,000 to pursue professional development opportunities at post-secondary so they can attend community college or university level courses.
Okay, so you're taking existing teachers but saying we need teachers more in these high need fields, so we want to redirect them in that direction?
Absolutely, yes. The intent behind this legislation was to give these fields that oftentimes don't have as many people pursuing, such as physics, biology, different mathematics, computer science. And these are fields that really a lot of schools, they want the opportunity to have this person in the classroom, but they don't have somebody to teach it. And so we're filling those vacancies that a lot of schools in Arizona see, both public schools and charter schools. And I think long term, we hope to see that we're pushing out more students with STEM-related attainment and post-secondary levels.
But also in Arizona, we've been for several years now hearing a lot about the general teacher shortage, just that there aren't enough teachers to fill the classrooms in the state. Is this an effort to try to counter that?
Definitely, this is an effort to assist with the teacher shortage, particularly in these high-need content areas where we see it extreme. In general, the teacher shortage is an issue. I think they see this pilot program based on the numbers that come through, maybe seeing this grow in the future and maybe beyond the STEM and CTE. I could see that happening. We really do want our educators to be qualified and to explore other fields such as STEM and CTE. So this is a great opportunity for, say, a current English teacher who's always had an itch to maybe get into physics. This would be an opportunity for them to attain those credits to be able to go and teach in a physics classroom in the future.
Yeah, and from a teacher's point of view, it's probably a good career move, right? Because these are areas that are in demand and they probably would provide some job security, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of teachers would love to add additional credentials or certifications to their teaching certificate and just their resume. And this is the perfect opportunity for them to do it.
So this isn't going to bring new teachers into the field, but you're hoping to give some teachers some job security and get them into areas that you really need it. Talk a little bit about what the need is in these STEM fields and in these career and technical education fields.
Definitely the STEM field, particularly in the sciences and higher level mathematics, we see those being fields that schools have a very hard time filling. And this will give the opportunity for some teachers that maybe are in a field that obviously we have a very big teacher retention and recruitment issue all over the board, but maybe give them the opportunity to shift into these high need content areas and maybe, you know, new educators that are coming in that have an approved area of English, which we see more of that than, say, physics, that will give them the opportunity to down the road, if this pilot program expands and is successful, that teacher could then turn over and pursue these high need content areas as well.
Yeah. So in light of that greater teacher retention issue and just getting people into the field in general, there's been a lot of talk about how terrible this is and how difficult it is for schools and how detrimental it can be for students. What I wonder is, are there other programs like this? What else is the Department of Education able to do to try to keep those teachers in the classroom and recruit new ones?
Absolutely. I think in general, Superintendent Douglas recently just put out a Proposition 301 expansion extension. And that is one major way that we can get teachers in the classroom and keep them in the classroom. The number one thing that we hear at the department and throughout the state is the need to pay teachers more. So I think that is number one priority that needs to be done. This is a great opportunity for teachers to take advantage of this professional development scholarship program. But ultimately, we really need to get to the root of the problem, which is teacher pay. And that's going to resolve the recruitment and retention issue.
So this is a pilot program. What do you hope happens with it? Do you hope it can be expanded in the future?
I think that the goal would be to expand it. I think there will be a long-term outcome with this program. We won't see immediate numbers right away, but we will likely see, we hope to see the STEM fields at post-secondary attainments, higher graduation rates out of that, and then also just in general, just schools offering more courses such as physics, biology, higher level mathematics. That's what we hope to see out of it. It's not going to be 1 year of immediate results. It'll be a long-term, but definitely something that can be successful.
Alexis Sustorf is a senior policy analyst with the Arizona Department of Education.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.